Got you, Joe. W-H-R-I-Y, recognized. K2RIW here. We begin the TechNet as we do most Sunday evenings at this time. Main purpose of the TechNet, as you guys have heard so often, is education. We curious amateurs gather at this time and share information about what we've learned about how wireless equipment works and how to make it work better. Transmitters and receivers and antennas and transmission lines and propagation. Tonight when we get to the second section of the TechNet, Roy AC2GS has a nice puzzle for you that will keep you busy, as well as a number of other subjects. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net. They give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. Probably a lot of people are away on vacation, so we might not have very many people tonight. We'll find out if it's going to be an empty net. So that's the first section. The second section is where Roy, AC2GS, gives us a science talk and a mailbag. And the third section is where Paul, WS2N, gives us the space report. Let me drop. And there was a recent launch of a unmanned craft, which I think was SpaceX. It was supposed to go to the International Space Station. And one of the... Okay, now's the time to check in. If you do have a question or a comment for the net, try to remember to give me your call letters, your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. The word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. Try to remember to wait for the beep so you don't time out the machine. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and we're listening for sign-ins right now.
This is WS2N. I just checked my audio. By the way, that's Boeing. How's my signal tonight, Dick?
Beautiful, Paul. And Paul, you're checking in. Do you have a question tonight? Yes. Are you signing in because you have a question for the first section of the TechNet? Back to you, Paul.
No, I'm not. I just wanted to check the signal. And I just wanted to let you know it was Boeing, not SpaceX, on that mission.
Yep. So that was Boeing. And what was the name of that craft, Paul?
Starliner. So yeah, that'll be the main topic. I think it's big news anyway. Back to you, Dick.
You're saying you do think it's big news? Is that what you just said, Paul? Go ahead.
I think it's big news. I think it's a big step in the right direction. There was some problems, but I think they're going to get over it.
Yeah, I think I heard that that launch, portion of that launch, took place in between two of the satellites that allow you to monitor it, so therefore they didn't have direct communication with it in order to correct for the extra burn. Is that roughly what happened? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that added complications. You know, there was a problem with the timer, and then they needed to take it over manually, you know, from the ground. And because the Tedra satellites, they were switching from one to the other, you know, the tracking data relay satellites, you know, you have east, west, you know, they were switching from one geosynchronous satellite to the other. And they lost a little bit of time in that, too, and wound up beating up too much fuel.
So when it made a burn that was too long, does that mean it ended up in an orbit that was too high to mate up with the International Space Station? Is that roughly what happened, Paul? Go ahead.
The thrusters were firing, trying to correct things. It thought it was further way downrange, and it wasn't, so it was trying to correct itself and get it back to where it was supposed to be. And in the process, they were using up too much fuel, so that's what happened there. It's a timer issue, so I'm sure they worked that out. But the timer on board Starliner, they go by mission elapsed time from zero, and for some reason that thing was set 11 hours later. So it was fouled up, one foul up after the other, and then they like you said, the tracking data relay satellites, they didn't, because it was a switchover, they didn't have enough time to reprogram it from the ground to take over manually in time. You know, they took over, but too late.
Very good, Paul. So we'll be hearing a little bit more about that. Okay, we've got Joe so far that's signed in. Paul, without a question, but giving us good information, and you sound good tonight. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. Now, it looks like we're going to have a light night tonight. Not as many check-ins. I guess there's probably some other subjects that I could have picked up. Last week we did talk about anechoic chambers, the pyramid size of the pyramid shape of the absorbers on the wall, the carbon-loaded foam. We talked a little bit about the collision avoidance radars that's on modern automobiles and why multiple automobiles side by side essentially don't interfere with each other. Kind of what other subject we could go into. Maybe you guys will think of one and ask it. So, we'll have one more standby if anybody wants to check in, because you do have a question or a comment for the net. And if there's no more check-ins, then we'll go over to Joe. So, any more check-ins right now, give me your call letters and name, please.
WA2VDH, yes.
Okay, WA2VDH. And I should know your name. Please tell me your name, sir.
Yeah, this is John. Handler's John.
Very fine, John. So far we have Joe and John. One last call. Anyone else to check in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the net. Please give me your call and name right now.
KD2F2B, Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Juliet Bravo. Name here is Lee from the Echo Echo.
Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Juliet Bravo. We got you, Lee. Okay, and one more call. Anyone else that wants to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, listening. Okay, no further on. So, Joe, WA2RYY, what's the latest in your research this week? WA2RYY, K2RIW.
WA2RYY, I found out some more information about, I can't find a direct formula. I'll talk about, by the direction of that question, they're asking about measuring AM distortion, or carry with a modulation measuring distortion. And they're giving the example here, but they don't give you a formula. They're telling you, say, if a carry has got 50% modulation, the first two sidebands are down 12 dB, and the second sidebands are down 40 dB. And then they're telling you to go by the ratio between the first set of sidebands to the second set of sidebands. That difference, in this case, is 28 dB, and that equates to 4% distortion. I'm not sure how they figured this out. Have you ever heard of this method being used before?
Well, now we've got to figure out, when they talk about percentage of distortion, are they relating it in a power manner or a voltage manner? The 28 dB of delta, you can convert that back into voltage by dividing by 20 and then take the anti-log of minus 28 and stand by while I actually relate distortion, not as a power percentage, but as a voltage percentage. Stand by while I give that a try, Joe. And go ahead and say whatever you want to for the next couple of minutes while I do this punching into the calculator.
Okay, 70% modulation. First set of sidebands are down 12 dB, which makes sense. And the second set of sidebands are 40, and I think I've measured it in actuality on an AM transmitter, and they look about approximately where they're supposed to be also. They're measured
80% of the modulation, that comes out to be like minus 8 dB and minus 30 or 32 dB. One comment I have, I tried the IRLP earlier and yesterday. I'm not sure what the issue is, if it's a reflector subchannel or the actual node equipment you're connected to the reflector channel with, but it seems to be one-way transmissions. People on the IRLP can hear you talking out to them, but you can't get back from the IRLP back into the system to be heard over the transmitter. So there may be people on IRLP that can't get back because they're trying to transmit, but the system doesn't hear them, your system doesn't hear them coming back. Not sure what the issue is right now.
Yeah, I don't listen to IRLP, but I do listen to my signal coming back out of Sheldon, and I'm hearing my signal coming out. So my transmission, what I can hear, which, as I said, I don't listen to IRLP. By the way, I took the 28 dB of difference between the 12 dB down first side lobe and 40 dB down for the second side lobe, 28 dB of delta, and it's a negative delta, so I put in minus 28 into my calculator. Then to convert that back into a voltage ratio, not a power ratio, you divide by 20, not divide by 10, and anti-log of that, you end up with 0.0398, it's 4. It is 4% of the voltage. So as a voltage ratio, and that's apparently the way they rate distortion, Joe, not as a power ratio, as a voltage ratio. So 28 dB is 4% less voltage on the second harmonic versus the first harmonic. So anti-log with voltage, in other words, divide by 20 instead of divide by 10, does seem to make it work right. Does that seem to make some sense, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW, the second ad.
So you're not putting 28 divided by 20, you're putting minus 28 divided by 20, and then taking the anti-log of that. Is that what you're doing on the calculator?
That's exactly it, Joe. The reason you can use a minus 28 is the 40 dB is weaker than the 12 dB, so it's negative dBs. How much weaker? In order to convert that into a voltage ratio, you divide the dBs, the 28 dB by 20, and then take the anti-log of that minus 28 divided by 20, and you'll end up with 4%. So apparently harmonic distortion is rated as a voltage ratio, not a power ratio. A little bit opposite of common sense, but I guess that's the standard that they've settled on, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Well, okay, now I understand how it works, and I understand what they're sort of asking, because this has to do with testing I'm involved with. Okay, very good. It's interesting. It's an interesting topic to talk about, so now I understand, I guess, the meat and potatoes behind the formula, or how the formula works. Very good. Thanks, Dick.
Yeah, there's a number of things. I think SINAD might also work with voltage instead of power. The 12 dB SINAD ratings for... when you're at 50% modulation, that particular amplifier in question produced a second harmonic with amplitude modulation, 50%, which is 40 dB, minus 40 dB compared to the carrier, I guess, versus the minus 12 dB versus the carrier for the fundamental. So... I'm guessing that's a Class A amplifier, and that's the level of distortion it had. If the amplifier was perfect, the second harmonic would be not showing up at all, infinite dB down, as well as all the other harmonics. And if there was a second harmonic, a third harmonic, and a fourth harmonic, you also then rate the total harmonic distortion. And there is that adding up the voltages, adding up the powers, and then converting into a voltage. I'm not sure how they do that. But in the example you gave, where they only worried about the second harmonic, we now know where the 4% number came from, voltage ratio. So, anything else you want to talk about tonight, Joe, before we move to the next person? W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, nothing else on the plate for this week, Dick. Thanks very much, W2RYY. I'll be on next week to continue another topic of something I asked a couple of weeks ago. About the measurements with the signal strength between myself and another amateur. I have to complete some more tests before I can present that data over here.
Yeah, when it comes to guessing at how strong a signal should be between you and somebody else, a known distance away, when you get all kinds of jazz in the terrain, water power towers and trees and buildings and houses and whatever, trying to calculate how strong the signal should be, depending on where he is compared to the antenna pattern you're using, how high your antenna is above the ground, that's kind of complicated. And particularly when nothing is moving. If you were in an automobile, you would see peaks and valleys as you go through the various phases of the distance between the two and all the reflections. But so I think you're talking about your fixed antenna at your house and his fixed antenna at his house and how strong the signal is between the two. Not easy to predict that one. Measurement is doable, but predicting it is a little bit tough. Or you could make some guesses as to, it's probably going to be stronger than this and probably weaker than that. Next person who signed in was John, the B2VDH, the B2 Victor Delta Hotel, K2 Romeo India Whiskey. You got it, John. My name is Dick.
Just cut in for a moment to just give you a piece of information about the data I was just talking about the distortion. That whole, it was handed to me a bunch of papers that have to do with AM and FM measuring carry with a spectrum analyzer. This might interest you if you want to look this up sometime. But this whole information, like a several pages of printout, comes from www.keysight.com. So they apparently have a page on their website that you can download this information. I guess it's probably in a PDF or something like that. If you're interested in looking at it yourself, WHROY.
Very fine. That's good information, Joe. Okay. John, the B2VDH, go right ahead with your question, John. K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
Oh, yeah, fine business, Vic. K2IWWH2VDH. Yeah, my question has to do with low-frequency monitoring. I recently got a low-frequency antenna and preamp to hook up to my receiver, the NRD515 Japan Radio Company receiver, just to listen on low frequency, below the broadcast band, going down to about 100 kilohertz. I used to listen to the beacons a number of years ago. Haven't done it lately, but I just started again a couple of weeks ago. I noticed there's a lot of garbage. I don't know if it's from these new flat-screen TVs. As I said, the last time I monitored was years ago before these flat-screen TVs became very popular. I was just wondering if there's any other people who have done any monitoring have noticed a lot more just noise and I call it garbage, but it does harmonically related. I was just wondering if there's been any other notice of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, your audio could be a little bit louder, John. Good signal in that, a little bit of noise in the background, and I'm hearing you on the input. You said the noise is periodic. In other words, you're getting that every 20 kc or every 15 kc. That's one answer, one question I've got. And what are you using for an antenna and a preamp? One of the things you got to worry about is that on those low frequencies, I'm guessing you're using a pretty long piece of wire going into a preamp. The possibility exists that there's some strong signals in your neighborhood that might be overloading the preamp, and therefore you're getting mixing going on in the preamp between that strong local signal, maybe it's a broadcast signal, and the things that you want to listen to. So the right kind of a pre-selecting filter, if you're listening to 100 kc, it would be awful nice to have a filter tuned to exactly 100 kc, only passing that between the antenna and the preamp. So, and one of the ways you can find out is the interference you're hearing coming from the overload of your own equipment. This is not an easy one, but if you had a way of plugging in an attenuator between your antenna and the preamp, and if you plugged in, let's say, 10 dB of attenuation, if the preamp is running in a linear manner, every single signal that you see on, say, the spectrum analyzer should go down by exactly 10 dB. because you plugged in a 10 dB attenuator. If you are getting overload of the preamp, then some of those signals will go down by some other ratio, maybe 15 or 18 dB that go down when you add the 10 dB of padding. So adding 10 dB of padding between the antenna and the preamp is one way of doing a test that gives you a pretty strong clue as to whether or not the noise you're hearing is really in the vicinity of the frequency you're listening to, or is it a mixing going on from overload of your own equipment. Does some of that make some sense, John? W2VDH, T2RW. What are you using for an antenna and preamp? Go ahead.
Yeah, fine, this is, I'm using one of these, it's called low waves. It's actually a very compact, low-frequency antenna in a, I guess, a PVC rod, and it does have a preamp, which I have right here in the shack, that I have. Now, my receiver actually has an attenuator in it, but like you say, I need to put the attenuator before the preamp, just to see if there is, you know, intermods and overloading occurring in the preamp. But I noticed that some of the stuff does disappear when I shut off my TV upstairs. But I was just wondering if some of this could be coming from other TVs, since it is periodic. It is going in 15, sometimes 20 kilohertz intervals, which I think relates to some of the scan rates, you know, for the high definition scan rates from other TVs in the neighborhood. As far as some of the beacons and stuff, I can still copy a couple of the beacons. As a matter of fact, one of the beacons, FR, on 407 kilohertz, I know where that beacon is. It's right along Seaford Oyster Bay. And it's an approach beacon for Farmingdale Republic Airport. But there's just so much other stuff there that means. But I am going to try that attenuator before the preamp. Go ahead.
Quite often in a receiver system, the preamp gives you nice low noise signal reception for a weak signal. Maybe it's got 10 or 20 dB of gain. And quite often what happens is the preamp itself is not overloading. It's a receiver component downrange when there's more gain throughout the receiver chain that it does the overloading. So therefore, plugging in 10 dB of attenuation after the preamp still gives you good information. If you get anything other than exactly 10 dB of attenuation of every one of the signals and components you're listening to, that tells you overloading is taking place downrange. So putting the attenuator after the preamp still gives you good information, because in many situations, the signal is not strong enough to overload the preamp, but after you get much more gain downrange, something downrange overloads. So where you put in the attenuation and what results you get, step by step you can find out how much of it is preamp, how much of it is the rest of the receiver. The actual antenna you're using, does it tune to the frequency you're listening? I mean, there are certain kinds of low-frequency antennas you can buy, which are a magnetic structure with a great big knob on the front, where you can tune it to an individual frequency. It resonates at the frequency you're listening to. That would be a very nice pre-selecting filter if your antenna had that that function, John. W2VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, fine. This is actually, this antenna is designed to peak up between a range of 2 kilohertz, way down low, all the way up to about the middle of the broadcast band, about 1 megahertz. So it's pretty much designed for very low frequency and low frequency reception up to the middle of the broadcast band. And yes, on the attenuator, the receiver I have, this is the NRD-515 Japan Radio Company receiver. It does have a built-in attenuator of 10 dB and 20 dB and out of the circuit altogether, which I have done that test. And the, as I say, what I call the garbage does drop down 10 dB. and 20 dB when I switch in the 10 or 20 dB attenuator in the receiver. So I think my next step is to try it before the preamp, just to see what would happen in that case. Go ahead.
Hey, that's a good sign that you plug in 10 and 20 dB of attenuation, and everything you're listening to, every single signal component, goes down by exactly 10 and 20 dB. That suggests that there's no overload and intermixing taking place in the rest of the receiver downrange. And now, plugging the attenuator in front of the preamp, we'll find out that the preamp is overloading. And that's not so likely, particularly where your antenna is tuned. Hopefully your antenna is a Gaussian-shaped filter, and if you tune it to a 402, for instance, it's passing 402 plus or minus some number of kilohertz and attenuating everything else. If that's the way your antenna behaves, then I think you're going to get good news with the attenuator in front of the preamp going down by exactly the right number. After you pass that test, which gives you strong indication that most likely the phony signals are not coming from your receiver system, then it sounds like they are real. And so at those low frequencies, all kinds of power supplies, fluorescent lighting, the circuits in the television sets, they can all make frequencies at those, they can all generate phony signals. The periodicity, I think you said, is sometimes every 15 kilohertz. And so on some television sets, the horizontal scan rate is 15.75 kilohertz on the old-fashioned analog days. Digital, I think, is very different. So if you do find out that the signals are coming in from the outside world, then what changes can you make to the antenna to favor one particular direction and to get rid of the noise? Maybe if you do your listening at 2 o'clock in the morning when people have turned off their television sets and their fluorescent lighting, the signal you want to listen to will sound better. That's another test you can do, John. WA2VDH, K2LIW. So you're a DC bander. You go down below the broadcast band. Not too many people do that. And I think the amateur service does have the ability to transmit on some of those frequencies. Is that true, Joe? John? WA2VDH, K2LIW.
Yes, I think so. I know. I think we have an allocation around 490 kilohertz, and I think we have something down even lower in the vicinity of 135 kilohertz. So, yeah, there are some allocations down there. Actually, I have an older receiver, too, the RBA-5. I don't know if you're familiar with that receiver. I bought it years and years ago back on Cortlandt Street. Don't ask me how I got it home through the subway. The thing must weigh about 100 pounds. That's a whole other story in itself. But that's sitting out in the garage, and it came off a battleship, and it's built like a battleship. I had that fired up one time, and it's a TRF receiver, but it's quite a monster. I was hoping to be able to monitor that station, SAQ, I don't know if you heard about it. They use an alternator. They transmit every now and then during the year. They go out at 17.2 kilohertz, and I think they're going to have a Christmas broadcast. So I got this low-frequency antenna to hope to be able to monitor them for that broadcast, but don't think I'll be able to do it. Anyway, thanks for the information. Dick, really appreciate it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're talking about that Scandinavian station that puts out a tremendous signal. I think they run a fraction of a million watts, and it's a great big mechanical alternator. In other words, it's a rotary machine that's generating the 17 kilohertz signal. And they sometimes have breakdowns of it. But listening to it should be a lot of fun. And a buddy of mine was doing that with a great big multi-conductor cable. He had in a great big loop, and he had wired the ends of it together so that it was multiple turns. The biggest requirement for an HF antenna at those frequencies, in many cases, is that the antenna must resonate at the frequency you want to listen to if you want best reception. If you can force your antenna to resonate at the frequency you're listening to, and you get a hell of a lot better reception. And it acts as a the first end filter. The antenna itself becomes a filter, passing only the signal you care about. Now, if local television sets are emitting signals on that frequency, then there's no way of eliminating it if they're really there, if you know what I mean, without telling people to turn off their equipment. So if your antenna will resonate at 17 kilohertz, then listening to that Scandinavian station could work out very well for you, John. The B2VDH, I think you're saying that happens on what, Christmas Eve, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, they several times a year they fire that station up for a demonstration transmission. I know that. I think they do it sometime midsummer. I think the next one is scheduled, I think, for Christmas Day sometime. And also, I think they do it again around Easter. They do it about three or four times a year, and they invite signal reports from around the world. But yeah, it's a mechanical carrier generation. Actually, they use a mechanical alternator, and their carrier frequency, of course, it's CW, is at 17.2 kilohertz. So it's rock bottom radio high. Okay, back to you, Dick.
A few more words about how that generator is built.
Very fine, Wes. John, do you know roughly how many watts they put out? Is that ever published? I think they. I think it runs a large number of watts. Is that true, John?
Yes, it is very high power. As I say, their carrier is really generated by an AC generator, so it is very high power. There is a thing on the net where they show them firing up. They show the alternator coming up to speed, shown on their last transmission a year or so ago.
Yeah, what's the name of that station, or what's the call letters of that station? I think it's in Scandinavia. Is that true, John?
Yeah, I believe it's SAQ. Sierra Alpha Quebec. I think it's SAQ, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, so I guess if I Google SAQ, I'll find out more information about it. Let's see what Wes has got to say about all this. You've got it, Wes. K2RIW.
I was interested if somebody knows more about it. So what I find out is very low frequency in Sweden, called sign SJQ, Morse code 17.2 kHz, and tuning at 0730 UTC, that's a VLF station, connects the long wire into the computer microphone socket. I use 1.8 MHz half wave dipole. So it looks like 1.8 could somehow resonate at 70 kilohertz. That's what I understand from that article. Let me jump. Disconnect the antenna before a storm and when not in use, okay? The next day, test after this will be on Sunday, 28 June 2009. So that was from 2009, the information about the guy. Yes, it was received in Sydney, Australia, and in some other places. So I'm really puzzled how that mechanical generator looks like, if somebody knows that tricks it.
I think there's some articles that actually show you physical picture of the thing. It's a very large alternator, I would call it. Large diameter thing that spins at very high speed with a whole lot of individual poles to it to get it all the way up to 17.2 kilohertz. And I think it runs a million watts or some crazy number like that, Wes. Wes, have you ever attempted to listen to that signal? What is it called now? SAQ. Have you ever attempted to listen to it, Wes? InterXJN, K2RIW.
No, I didn't, but definitely this is at the base of my interest, 70 kilohertz, 18 kilohertz, is a frequency that I'm extremely excited about. And I would like you to tell me how you can make a relatively small antenna that could be used as a probe for spotting that signal into a ship.
Yeah, what's crazy about that lower frequency is I think it's coming to us by way of the ionospheric reflection. The signal itself doesn't change very fast. If you had an antenna that's full size at 17 kilohertz, it would be a mile long, something really big, and you tried listening with it at, say, 10 feet off the ground and 100 feet off the ground, I think you would see not very much difference. The antenna itself, at that lower frequency, because the amount of noise in the band is so loud, you don't need a full-size antenna. A loop antenna a couple of feet in diameter with multiple turns to the wire loop with a tuning capacitor across the ends so that it resonates. As long as your loop antenna resonates at 17.2 kilohertz, it will be a good magnetic loop detector. And if it's a vertically polarized signal, you don't radiate broadside to the loop, you radiate in parallel to the loop, if you know what I mean, off the end. And so creating a good impedance match between that loop and your receiver is a little bit of a problem. But once you get a good impedance match, listening to that signal doesn't require a huge, large antenna. Relatively small antenna can do it, is my belief, Wes. So homebrewing something with multiple turns. My buddy, the way he did it, is he had a multi-conductor cable that's normally used by a telephone system. And I think he took about 10 feet of that cable, turned it around into a great big circle. Because the cable had 30 individual strands or something like that to it, he wired the individual strands together at the junction where the ends of the cable came together, so that he ended up with multiple turns. And the final beginning turn and last turn, a capacitor across it, made it resonate. Now, no grid dip meter goes down to 17 kilohertz. How you confirm resonance, I guess you have to do it with a signal generator and an oscilloscope, if you know what I mean. And now, how do you get an impedance match to that? There, I'm not sure. But a relatively small antenna, I think, can do it, Wes. And there's probably some articles on the internet that'll tell you how to do that. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm always, at this frequency, I'm always puzzled with the Marconi from Canada to United, to England, first communication over the radio waves. And I have an article in front of me, Radio Science, Volume 13, Number 6. It was pages 969 to 967 from November, December 1978. Let me drop. And it's by Institute of Telecommunications Science, National Telecommunication and Information Administration of U.S. Department of Commerce, by David Hill, and the textization of Zenex surface waves by vertical aperture. So you said about vertical polarization of it. So that could be possibly, that what many scientists were suspecting, that you're not really dealing with a wave that is bound from the ionosphere, but the ground wave that is traveling the interface. And that would be the surface wave of each kind. Entering here.
Yeah, this situation is a little bit like what happens when you take a random length of wire, say for instance 80 meters, just a clip lead with a couple of feet of wire on it, connected to the center conductor of the UHF connector on the back of your receiver, and you listen to an 80 meter signal. And the signal will sound beautiful. You don't get very much deflection of the S meter. So the antenna itself may be running at 1% efficiency, so to speak, because of a lack of resonance. It's got an effective capture area that's, let me think about that now. Yeah, it's a non-resonant antenna. Because you're, maybe, what you're listening to is going to be 20 dB weaker than if you had a full-size antenna, but the noise is 20 dB weaker, the signal is 20 dB weaker, the signal-to-noise ratio sounds the same. So, you listen to this random length of wire, you hear somebody on signal on 80 meters, you don't get much estimated deflection, but he sounds beautiful coming out of the loudspeaker. You then go over to a full-size antenna, and you get a great big deflection on the S-meter, signal transmitter on your receiver, but the signal-to-noise ratio sounds the same. So it's kind of confusing. You can't transmit back through that random length of wire, but receivers are very forgiving. So I'm guessing the noise on the band at 17 kilohertz could be quite significant due to atmospheric static and thunderstorms and everything else that's going on around the world. So the noise being as high as it is, you don't need a full-size antenna. As long as your antenna hits resonance, it will work. And a tiny antenna that resonates, the magic of resonance is you suddenly build up a very large, effective capture area of the antenna. It's kind of amazing. So I'll bet you there are articles telling you how to do this on the internet if you choose the right spot. Drag your feet a little bit when I pass it back to you. Let's see if anyone else has ever done any listening down at 17 kilohertz or any other very low frequency. If so, give me your call letters right now. N2XJN with a delay to take it. K2RIW in the second half.
I have a question, WE2CDL.
Go ahead, Andy.
Did you say 17 KC? That low?
That's a roger. That Scandinavian station in Sweden, SAQ, which a few times per year does a memorial transmission, it's around a megawatt of power, 17.2 kilohertz is generated not with tubes, not with transistors. It's a very large rotary machine. It's an alternator with a whole lot of poles to it. Alternator generator set being fed with a whole lot of power on the motor that drives this thing. And 17.2 kilohertz. If you're a very young person, you could actually hear that frequency, if you know what I mean. When I was young, I could hear the 15 kilohertz coming out of the television set when I would enter somebody's house when I was doing television repair. I don't hear those anymore. So 17.2 kilohertz can be radiated if you got a big enough antenna and a powerful enough transmitter in Sweden to do it. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it, Andy? The B2CDL, KQRIW.
Yeah, it is. Why such a low frequency? I just turned the radio on and I heard 17 KC and I said to myself, that's not a ham band, because we do have allocations up at 100 and, I was just reading about this in the QST magazine, I think it's about 160, 170 KC. There is an allocation, an amateur allocation, that's the word, you know, allowed on that band, but not 17 KC. That's why I didn't know. I had no idea the station is transmitting that. That's the first I'm hearing of it. That's why I questioned it. Okay, sounds interesting. And I guess, if I get a large enough size property, I can put the antenna up. That'll receive the signal. Even though, like you say, just a random long wire. I use just a random long wire to receive under 75 meters, and it works fine. Even though it's not resident. I'm not going to transmit it, but I can receive it. All right, back to you.
VDH with a comment.
I have a comment.
Yeah, VDH first. Go ahead, VDH. You got it, John.
A good case in point. Look at these atomic clocks. They receive at 60 kilohertz. That's WWVB. They go out at 60 kilohertz, they don't have a very big antenna in them. They have a pretty small antenna. Yet they do a good job of picking up that signal. And I think that signal has phase modulation on it too. So they have to do a pretty good job of receiving that signal. Go ahead.
Yeah, the antenna that's inside that watch that's receiving that 100 KC signal is obviously very small. The size of the antenna is not as important as making sure the antenna resonates. 17.2 kilohertz and frequencies like that, Andy, I think the main advantage of that is you get worldwide coverage. If you can send out a strong enough signal on that lower frequency, it can be picked up almost anywhere in the world. That extended ground wave, for it to be strong enough to be above the noise on the band, is doable if you're radiating megawatts of power. There's a communication system like that called a command receiver that's used to talk to our submarines. You can have an antenna below the seawater, a long piece of wire dragged behind the submarine, and the antenna is some number of feet below the seawater, and the United States has the ability to transmit the signals to that, a very low frequency, a very slow data rate signal. Morse code can be sent to the submarine. So these super low frequencies give you worldwide coverage. So the antennas that we could build doesn't have to be very big, as long as it hits resonance and it's properly oriented, and you get a good impedance match between that antenna and the front end of your receiver. Listening to that signal is a bit different than you would think. At 17 kilohertz, you would think a dipole would have to be a mile long. All you've got to do is have a magnetic loop that hits resonance, in my opinion. N2XJN, K2RIW, are you going to give it an attempt or west? Go ahead.
I look at Marconi's transmission and his transmitter, and he was using frequency anywhere from 15 kilohertz up to 272 kilohertz. And he got a Nobel Prize that was then revoked by the United States government to Tesla, who was left in 1944. Let me just. The problem that I have is it really that we're dealing with radio waves that is bounced from ionosphere? Are we dealing with the surface wave that actually bends through the curvature of the Earth? Many years ago, Zenek, that was 1907, showed that the surface wave, which is a solution to Maxwell's equation, could be supported by planar interface separating two homogeneous media when upper medium is air and lower medium is dissipative ground, and that creates the interface. So the Zenek surface wave is characterized by phase velocity greater than the light and an attenuation in the direction of propagation along the interface. So the wave is attenuated with the height above the surface. It can bend and travel along the curvature of the Earth. I would like you to say a few words about it. Thank you.
Yeah, how that propagation takes place, I'm not sure, Wes. Is it pure surface wave? Is there an ionospheric reflection? Is the ionospheric layer in the Earth acting like a piece of waveguide, which is one of the modes of operation that you've been interested in the past? You know, I'm not sure. I'd like to believe that there are some websites that will explain this to us. But the advantage of those frequencies is that if you put out a strong enough signal, you know, a good fraction of a megawatt of power at that frequency, it can be heard worldwide in strange places, like up to 60 feet below the surface of seawater, you can hear that signal. It goes everywhere. And so, does it propagate faster than the speed of light? There, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit doubtful about that one, but it's possible. Extended ground wave. And how it really gets there, I'm not sure, but it does get there. But because the original signal is so strong, very simple antennas, that as long as the antenna hits resonance, and picking it up magnetically is probably the easiest way. A magnetic loop that resonates. It doesn't have to be a very big loop with the right impedance match. And that impedance match can be by way of a balun and gamma match and whatever, you know, tap into a certain number of turns onto that multi-turn antenna. That's the way you're doing it. And to estimate how many kilohertz, how many, what's the number of microhenries your loop has? Say, for instance, you make it a 20-turn loop that's 5 feet in diameter. By way of that formula you've got in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, where you know the diameter of the loop and the number of turns, you put in that information to the formula, and it'll tell you with a good accuracy how many microhenries you're going to be getting. Once you know that number of microhenries, you can calculate how many picofarads of capacitance across the end of that will hit resonance. As long as the capacitor resonance and the inductor resonance equal each other, you've got a resonator. So to resonate that loop is your main function for reception. After that, an impedance match into your receiver will allow you to hear that signal. I'm pretty sure there are articles on the internet telling you how to do this. N2XJN for any further comments. And drag your feet in case other people know more about it than we do as to how the signal gets there. K2RIW listening.
Just another question, Dick, regarding this.
Go ahead, Andy.
Just clarify, because I'm just putting the pieces together. This is a radio station that's transmitting on 17KC, and what information are they transmitting? Is this music? Is this data? Is this news? And how long has this been going on for? And is this something new?
Not new at all. I'm not sure, but I think the signal, the station may have been established during World War II. It's a Swedish station. The antenna structure, when you see a picture of it, consists of, I'm going to make a guess, 150-foot high radio towers, maybe five of them along a string that are a mile between the first one and the last one. It's a mile of difference. A whole bunch of wires between those towers are strung across the tops of the towers. In the middle of the structure, a bunch of wires come down to the ground and it's connected to the transmitter. So it's a worldwide, very low-speed Morse code transmitting signal. I think it was done for communicating with ships at sea from Sweden during World War II is when I think it was established. The United States has a similar system called the Sanguin system, which allows us to transmit what's called command signals to our submarines. The nuclear submarines that we've got below the sea, not coming up to the surface, we can communicate with them with a multi-megawatt signal, which I think was at one time set up in Maine, a multiple mile-long wire antenna. I think there's one in Maine. I think there's one in Michigan. So these super low-frequency signals with a megawatt going into it allows you to have worldwide communication at those frequencies to your ship at sea or to your submarine.
Heavy information.
Go ahead, Wes, N2XJN. So I think that signal in Sweden maybe was established during World War II. It's a guess on my part. You got it, Wes.
The Forest Wireless Telegraph Company in 1902-1907 started first to make generators, mechanical generators, to transmit radio waves at low frequencies. But then it was actually the job of British firm of Marconi. In 1915, he began and work with General Electric. Then he had an exclusive use of transmitter of the day, and that was called Alexandron alternator. I believe you've heard about Alexandron one. Interaction.
Yeah, the actual generator, I think it's called an Alexander alternator, Alexanderson, something like that, in Sweden. So so maybe it was established even before World War One. But
1915.
You said 1915?
That is correct.
So it's around World War One. So these are some of the early Marconi experiments, apparently, for long-range radio communication. I'll bet your... it was wasn't a spot gap transmitter in those days. It was a real alternator turning out that frequency. To do that electromechanically, at the megawatt of power, that's a really big, elaborate machine, probably with fancy slip rings and whatever to actually generate that signal and transmit it to the antenna.
Yeah, and he is a puzzle, because some of the form of that generator, mechanical generator, was connected to the Tesla coil. And from the science of the wave that was used, we know that what is controversial, and you didn't agree to yet, but it's the conform the source, that infinite vertical aperture with the height variation corresponding to that of the Zenith wave will excite only the Zenith wave surface wave with the no radiation field. And that was the upsetting part of it to you. And that's by a number of American institutes. Enter it here.
AC2GS. Okay, Roy. AC2GS, your signal's a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you, Roy. You got it, Roy.
I'm tweaking up my power. Hopefully it'll be less noisy. Grimeton radio station was built between 1922 and 1924. It's based on that technology that predates it. It only was capable of 200 kilowatts of output. It was capable of a maximum of about 370 kilowatts, but it was never driven that high. And these days, it's never driven higher than 80 kilowatts. Marconi got a Nobel Prize. It wasn't taken away. Edison and Tesla never actually got a Nobel Prize. There was a rumor that they were going to get one, and one of them annoyed the Nobel Committee, but that's all just rumor.
I have a problem with that.
So are you saying, Roy, that there's a website giving you this information? Is that where you're getting it from? Back to you, Roy.
Indeed, Google is your friend, and Wikipedia is also. Sometimes you got to look at these things with a good BS meter, but this sounds legit, so I have no problems with these numbers. They make sense to me.
I have a problem with the statement about the Nobel Prize of Marconi given to Tesla. Would you disagree?
What was your search word with Google when you found the information on this one, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW?
Just put in low frequency SAC Sweden, and I got a whole bunch of links, and I took the one to Wikipedia. Has a very nice picture of it.
Marconi got the Nobel Prize in 1901. With honors, but then he started to work in Bolinas, California, and RCA, created by the government of the United States, closed its facility in 1921. Let me jump. He was trying to make the similar station to the Tesla Tower, trying to use, at that time he claimed, the Earth to transmit energy around the year. And in 1943, Tesla died, and a year later, Marconi started to sue the government of the United States for a big amount of money for illegal use of radio waves technology during the First World War. So to get away of it, after Tesla died, who didn't have a wife and a children, after his death, when the FBI went to his apartment in Manhattan, confiscated the letters, and then soon later after that, there was a court session that revoked a right from Marconi and gave it to that Tesla. And this way, United States government didn't have to deal with paying Tesla. Marconi and the money. Enjoy it.
Okay, Wesley, but that's a different thing entirely. You're talking about patents. Now you're talking about patents. Before, you were talking about Nobel Prizes.
Oh, absolutely, you're right. The Nobel Prize wasn't revoked. You're right. The patent was revoked. The Nobel Prize, yes, stayed in the hands of...